Quick, quick, and we'll get you tuned into the K103.7 FM Party Line Talk Show for Thursday, June 25th, 2015. Now, our guests today will be Ron Skye and Christine Yom-Zachary, and we're talking about the Justice Act. It was just recently accepted, and, you know, a lot of people have questions about it, so we're here to explain what the Justice Act is. So, Ron, let's start off with just, you know, basic, what is the Justice Act?
Well, I guess, well, thank you for having us on today. Unfortunately, I'll just remind you or advise you that Kevin Fleischer had to cancel. He had a previous engagement that he had to attend to. And I believe Christine's running a little late with council sessions this morning, so she'll probably join us later.
Right?
Yeah, very busy.
It's a big week there.
Very, very busy. So thank you for inviting us and having the opportunity, you know, to maybe communicate what the Justice Act is and maybe isn't, what the next steps could be, and get a little bit more information out to the community, you know, on how we're going to proceed next. So, the Justice Act itself was passed last week by council, but it's been in the making for quite a long time. Even though we got the initial we started the initial process in roughly 2007 and got the official mandate in 2010, there was a lot of work that was done historically in relation to researching what the community wanted in relation to justice. And it goes back to 1996, 1997. Well, probably even farther than that, yeah. But I'm talking in my time, I guess, what I was really involved in. So, there was a lot of work that was done from the 90s, just really like feeling out, you know, what the community wanted in relation to justice and what the scope could be. So there was some consultation sessions held back then. There was also some strategic sessions that were held by the Justice Commission with various stakeholders in the community on kind of giving us a general direction in where we may want to go or where the community want to go in relation to justice. With the development of the community decision-making process as well around the same time, you know, 2006-2007, and some of the, I guess, restrictions and even conditions that we were going to be facing in the future, and identified back then that we needed to do something in relation to providing justice or justice system to our community, the federal government, in relation to an decision out west, it was called the L decision, kind of put a moratorium on the appointment of justice of the peace under Section 107 of the Indian Act. So at that time, it kind of raised our eyes, saying, "Okay, what's going to happen now? I mean, in the event that there are no more appointments under 107."
Can I just ask a quick question? So there was a moratorium on new appointments.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So if we already had a justice of the peace in place, that person could continue in their role?
That's correct. Yes,
okay.
We had the last four remaining justices of the peace appointed under Section 107.
Mm-hmm.
So, knowing that there was going to be no further appointments, and the federal government had said if there will be a provincial appointments, you have to speak to the province. But based on that AL decision, the province also really curtailed or restricted the responsibilities of a justice of the peace appointed provincially, where they could only take pleas, they couldn't hear a case. So it meant more restrictions on us. So with that in mind, in 2007, we started this consultation phase, if you would, with the whole community and stakeholders, and I'm sure people can remember how involved we got at different times in trying to gather that information on what they actually wanted in relation to justice in the community. And then we progressed to the official mandate in kind of 2010, where we started another consultation with the community. And it was really a grassroots movement. The community who had participated when we got the mandate were very, very explicit at that time, stating that they didn't want anything that was pre-made or packaged and then given to them for review. They wanted to start right from scratch. So that's the mandate that we received. So we engaged in those discussions from 2010 on.
Okay. And what is the scope of the Justice Act? What is it going to be covering in Gunawage? What sorts of laws and what won't it be covering?
Well, part of the the mandate and the scope, if you would, that we received from the community was to touch on all aspects of justice, meaning criminal, penal, civil, family laws. But again, there's different levels, if you want, of what the community had stated. And when you talk about criminal law, they were very explicit also stating that they didn't want to hear any serious crimes. So the intention now...
In terms of serious crimes, are we talking about violent crimes?
Yes, if you're looking at murder, sexual assault.
I think we're talking major crimes here, though, which
That's
are the standard ones.
Well, standard being...
Murder, rape.
Yeah, sexual assault.
Armed robbery, I believe, is one of those.
Okay.
And there's one more.
Yeah, so if you're looking at it within the context of the criminal code of Canada, it's under Part 27, and there's a whole list of offenses that are contained in there which are... You can proceed by summary conviction, and then the prosecutor has an option of a hybrid offense, or making it indictable, or on a summary conviction offense. And the difference in that is that the sentences carry different fines, if you would, or jailed imprisonment. 2 years less a day is summary conviction. More than 2 years is a federal offense, and that's indictable. So that's how the difference is made up, or the separation of those charges, if you would. So as we said, the community was very explicit, saying they didn't want to deal with any of these major crimes. So we restricted it to Part 27. And again, the capacity, if you want, and the availability to provide these services, we're doing a lot of it right now within our current justice system with the Justice of the Peace under 107. So basically, for right now, in the transition mode, it will remain status quo. The option, though, or the addition to that is with the turning of the key, if you would, of the Justice Act, all of those files now are also available or an option to use restorative justice mediation. Obviously, that is the cornerstone of the whole justice system that the community wanted, is being to resolve conflict in a non-adversarial format. But that option, they also said, must be there in the event that the two parties can't come to some type of agreement on whatever the conflict is, that there has to be a recourse. So we had to build in those checks and balances, if you would, to address those concerns.
So the Justice Act has been accepted, but it's not necessarily being completely applied at this time.
No, there is that problem that we've not yet fully built the structure. We've got the laws in place and continuing laws being legislated.
So is it in terms of the administrative structures that need to be implemented at this time?
Well, you could call them administrative, regulatory.
Regulatory.
So if you look at the way the justice system is built right now, and I'll use an analogy, we have the shell, we have the frame, and right now we're putting in the wiring.
Yeah.
So part of that wiring is the restorative justice program. Okay, that's part of the wiring. And now all the other components of it.
Do we have the human resources in order to do this?
Well, that's an issue. We have to look at the human and financial resources that are going to be available or could be made available to the Justice Act to be able to implement it fully.
And really, it ties into your comment about the L decision, because as our remaining justices age and wish to retire, then we have to have that staff, that personnel, to be able to fill that position. So there is a concern.
So Gunawaga is going to be looking for more justice of the peace?
That means the development that we have to do with the outside, with Quebec, with whoever, in order to recognize and put in place our justices with the appropriate qualifications.
Okay.
We won't just have anyone... anyone coming into that position. These will be people with credentials.
The appropriate training in order to fulfill those positions.
But we have to be able to have negotiated that as part of this whole building that we're doing.
Okay, so that's still part of the plumbing and wiring that we're talking about.
Yes. And we're in discussions right now with Quebec in some of those issues. Again, the community had stated very clearly that... anyone who would sit on the bench, if you would, as a judge, had to have certain qualifications. They agreed to that. The next very critical issue that they identified was that any judgments that would be handed down from the bench needed to be recognized not only in Gunawagi, but exterior to the community.
Mm-hmm.
They also felt that way, that what's the use of having a judgment if it can't be enforced? So with that said, and you know, there was a lot of discussion about that on how it's going to be done, how is any other judicial district going to be able to recognize a judgment from Gunawagi exterior to the community. So that issue of reciprocal arrangements, if you would, needed or will need to be addressed with Quebec and even Canada at this point.
Reciprocal arrangements in terms of our laws being consistent with external laws. Is that it? Or,
well, not necessarily the law itself. I mean, the ability to make law, I think, and it should rest with the community. I mean, mm-hmm. but there are going to be areas that may be in conflict with a law that's in Quebec or Canada, and we're saying that our law would take precedence over that, even if there's a conflict. But then, how do you address that conflict, you know, within the law itself? Now, part of the issue with Quebec and even Canada may be their legal obligation in relation to their constitution. To ensure that natural justice, the charter issues are applied to the hearing of files or the sentencing and so on. So in relation to criminal files, if you would, I mean, we've been processing it that way since we've begun hearing criminal files. So the rights of an individual, if you would, are always protected. That's not going to change. But when it gets to a specific Gunawagi law, it could be membership or some, you know, another law, residency or whatever it might be. There's no jurisprudence out there really per se for, you know, a Gunawagi made law.
Mm-hmm.
What are going to be the criteria in relation to the judgment of it? What practices are going to be used? You know, we say natural justice, but what does it mean? Our charter issues, Canadian charter rights and values, going to be applied to a certain degree. That hasn't been hammered out yet. Do we need a Gunawagi charter or a Gunawagi constitution, you know, which could outline that, things which are big areas of development? And you have, you know, both sides of the coin, people saying no, we have our constitution, the Gayana Goa, that's it, but is it sufficient?
Mm-hmm.
So that discussion needs to take place as well.
Okay.
And there is that discussion always happening when people ask the question of what are our principles.
Yeah, that's right.
Of Ganyangehaga law. What are our principles?
Yeah. What are the values and principles in the law?
It's very difficult to answer that question because people haven't done the work yet.
And how is this law going to, or how's the Justice Act going to operate? Is it operating underneath the Indian Act or in conjunction with the Indian Act, or what's the relation
No,
there?
No, it's totally independent.
Okay.
If I can make another analogy, I mean, there are tribal courts in the United States,
mm-hmm.
but those are also recognized within the Constitution of the United mm-hmm. States. Tribal courts are recognized, but they fall under the state that they're in. So a tribal court would fall under New York state law. If it was in California, you know, that's how they operate. So there's recognition already within the United States Constitution on these tribal courts. In Canada, it's a unified system. In the Constitution, the delegation of powers, if you would, or the administration of justice is given to the province.
Mm-hmm.
So with the province now, it says, well, this is how we run our courts. This is how we ensure objectivity, security of tenure for the justices, independence, you know, all this stuff that are basic requirements to ensure objectivity and transparency in a justice system. And we've built that into... You know, the community has built that into the Justice Act itself, and nowhere else in Canada, within the First Nations territories or communities, has anybody or anyone ever tried to move this forward. So it's kind of putting Quebec and Canada on notice that this is what we're doing. We've been discussing it for a long time. I'm sure they realize the necessity, you know, of what we're doing right now, but... Now they have to look at how they need to change maybe their legislation to ensure consistency, if you want, in how their people or the outside community may view some type of arrangement or agreement with Kahnawake in relation to justice.
What kind of response have you gotten from Canada and Quebec in terms of, you know, like you said, they've been put on notice that this is going to happen. Have they given a response?
They've been actually quite receptive. You know, as I said, we've been discussing this with them for, I don't know, Christine, how long? Many years.
Back to 2003, I think.
Yeah. So it was part of it was with the CKR, you know, mm-hmm. Canada-Kahnawake relations. There was some discussions there, some agreements in principle. And then for everybody has their own interpretation of why the CKR process kind of dropped or failed, but it stopped there. Then there was some discussion with Quebec. And then most recently, in the last 6 months or so, Premier Couillard and the ex-Grand Chief, Mike Lille, had come to an agreement that the topic of justice is something that Quebec and Kahnawake needed to discuss in relation to what we're doing as far as our Justice Act is concerned and what Quebec may need to do in relation to how do they recognize that.
You know, Rhonda, there's something else there. The reason why the premiers will speak to us, there is a bit of an aspect, because we've already had recognition through Section 107, and we had a court that grew up from 1940 forward and evolved the way you have evolved it, and taking on summary offenses and hybrids. I mean, you've done a lot of expansion of our jurisdiction, and now when you asked, does it have anything to do with the Indian Act? Well, in a sense, the reason why the provincial government speaks to us and recognizes what we've done under the Section 107 is because of that act. So we are now putting our own act in place, yet we're going to have to stand on that 107 status that was accorded us because people recognize it on the outside. And that's how we get into the discussion. And they see what we are, what we have created. And then there is that liaison. They can trust what work we are doing. We're not a fly-by-night operation. We've certainly been at this kind of work for decades. And so people see that. People see the evolution of justice at Kahnawake. We just have to be able to have recognition. That's the important thing.
Okay, before we get into anything else, we're going to take a quick commercial break. For those of you who are just joining in to the K103.7 FM Party Line Talk Show, our guests today are Ron Skye and Christine Dion-Zachary. We're talking about the Justice Act. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. And we're back on the K103.7 FM Party Line Talk Show. For those of you just tuning in, my guests today are Ron Skye and Christine Dion-Zachary of the MCK. And we're talking about the Justice Act. So we've given a little bit of background and history into how the Justice Act was developed and the purposes of it. Now, how is it going to, and there's still some work to go on. We're aware of that.
Plenty of work.
Plenty of work to go on. What are some of the benefits? How is this going to benefit Kahnawake to have a Justice Act?
I think it becomes one of the pillars of this community. The community is no longer just 1,000 people. It's a fast-growing community. It has many businesses. It has many different services that have grown up and established itself. And it has issues. There are all kinds of issues that occur here. And we need to develop this now. And I think it's foresight that we developed it over a number of decades. And Ron can tell you what it was like when he first came on here. But certainly, the peacekeepers will tell us what the issues are now. They're expanded because we have more numbers. So we have to have this as a community in development.
For the everyday person in Kahnawake, how is this act going to facilitate maybe, you know, regular events in their life, or, you know, if they do become somehow involved in a justice issue? How is it? Is it going to make...
I was thinking just one area.
Yeah.
For instance, the mediations that happened in breakdown of marriages, that would be something that really is a service for an individual in the community. Or landlord-tenant issues, That's something that keeps coming across our desks. So people want to have some security with respect to that, and they need that as a service. It's something that has to be created and accorded to the community.
So it'll give easier access to legal services?
Yes, because within the community? There is no access in terms of landlord-tenant issues right now.
Right.
I mean, you cannot unless you go outside.
And then do we have to worry about language issues also? I'm expecting that since this is a Ganawage Justice Act, that people will be able to easily access service in English.
Definitely.
There's not going to be any, we don't have to worry about the province stepping on Ganawage's toes and saying, well, we want all your laws written in French.
No. I mean, I think that's... that ties into the whole language law.
You know, yes,
And obviously within the Justice Act itself, the provision of languages is there, that the individual has a choice to either have it in Kanyagaha or English, and French if it's a criminal matter. Okay, the court will provide those translation services. If it's for an issue between two individuals in a civil matter, then they will be required to pay for the translation services if they want to have it in a language other than Kanyagaha or English. So maybe just going back to your question on what it means for the community, I really look at it as a quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's individuals in the community have expressed how fast we've grown, the different types of business, social interaction, and we've evolved as a community. Life isn't as simple as it was back in the 40s or the 30s or the 50s or the 60s or the 70s. So the demand from the community to have these services is always there, and it's growing more, you know, saying, why do we have to go to an outside court? A lot of it, or a big part of it, I think, is in relation to Ganawage's assertion, if you want, in relation to jurisdiction, saying these are our laws. We want to make laws for ourselves that are reflective of the community, but we also need a place to go and interpret those laws. Hence, the court. You need some type of tribunal or a court to be able to interpret those laws. We also need that court system, if you want, and even the appellate division to ensure that if there's an interpretation given on a law, a decision, that the individual has the right to appeal that decision. You know, an individual has the right to redress, to appeal a decision of any court, but it should be within the appellate division of a court of Ganawage. And we need to get to the point where if an individual isn't satisfied with a decision from our court about a Ganawage law, that they don't go outside, meaning to the superior court, and ask for a review or an appeal. We need to get it to the point where that superior court looks at the petition and they recognize the fact that Ganawage has a responsibility and a jurisdiction to do that and refer that file back to our appellate court. You know, for them to say, no, we don't have jurisdiction over this law. It's not our law.
That's a key point.
Very, very important.
Yes. And it also has to come from a different way as well. There has to be trust built in the community so that outside petitions, outside process isn't invoked. But as well, having this, what you were just mentioning about judges realizing that we will have our jurisdictions recognized.
That's really critical.
Both ways.
And how is that going to come about? There's got to be some sort of negotiation process going on with not just the federal level, but also the provincial. So
exactly.
How's that process going to look, perhaps? Because we're not there yet.
Yeah, no, we've just begun the discussions, and there's two sides you have to look at. When you're looking at laws like criminal code, things like that, it's under the provincial domain, basically, at this point. But when you get to things that go to superior court, and it could be issues of marriage separation, divorce, which is a superior court issue, which is a federal responsibility. So now the federal government are the ones who appoint the judges to superior court. So part of the discussions, and we understand where Quebec may be coming from, saying, well, if there's something in relation to the provincial domain, we have no problem discussing these issues with Ganawagi and maybe coming to some type of agreement. When you get into the other side of the tract, if you would, that are under federal domain, the federal government may say, well, you know, we're not ready yet to discuss it. And now we're getting into issues of membership. You know, membership is a piece of federal legislation. S2 is federal legislation. The province is kind of saying, well, we don't know where it stands. It's only can be a superior court judge that would be able to adjudicate on these files. So you need to talk to the federal government in relation to your Justice Act, if you would, or the application of it. So there's two streams that need to go on in relation to the type of law that we're trying to develop and what is the responsibility, if you want, from the federal government in relation to that piece of legislation. So if it falls within a federal domain, and we're kind of maintaining that if we're looking at membership, you know, the federal government created this legislation S2. It's got nothing to do with the province, even though they're trying to delegate that responsibility to the province. There's still a provision in there that the council, if you would, or the community may appoint a tribunal. So that's under federal legislation. The province doesn't have jurisdiction under federal legislation, just provincial. So it gets very, very entwined, and we have to kind of parcel that out as we're going along. But as I said earlier, the discussions with Quebec have begun, and they're looking positive. You know, they're very receptive to what we've put forward. Obviously, they have some concerns in relation to. As I said earlier, their legal obligations because in relation to the general population outside of the territory, because a Ganawagi law would apply to them as well.
Right. So just for example, if a non-local person was caught speeding through the territory, right, they would be their case would be seen under this new Justice Act. Yep. Is that how it would work?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
It's not going to just apply to locals.
No, it'll be to everybody. So there's different processes that are involved. Mm-hmm. Right now, under the present scheme that we have, we don't apply seizure methods, if you would, for individuals who don't pay their fines. Mm-hmm. So people go to jail or pay the fine. But we know that changes within the whole provincial correctional service and system, they're shying away from imprisoning individuals for penal infractions, traffic infractions. So what does it mean now? It means that even though we may issue a warrant under this process that we have, the jail may not accept the individual. So if there's a fine of $500, $400, you know, there may
there's
be
no
a possibility.
Way to collect it.
There's no way to collect it. So if we look under this new Ganawagi justice system and have that reciprocal arrangement with the province to say, okay, yes, now we're going to, you know, you're recognizing or the jurisdiction that Ganawagi has. The judgments of the court are going to be recognized. So now the court could do the same process that's, you know, any other court has out there. We can have an administrative arrangement with the SAC, Société Automobile d'Assurance Quebec, to have that information recorded on there. So when the individual renews or tries to renew their license or their plates, it won't be renewed unless they come to Ganawagi to pay their fine. So it's things, administrative, you know, requirements or arrangements that would be made as well as that larger jurisdictional aspect of it.
Okay. Now, how is this going to affect things like laws that are going through the community decision-making process, just for example, like the matrimonial real property law that was, it went through the process last November, December, and then the Minister of, was it Indian Affairs,
yes,
would not approve it.
No.
So would this Justice Act prevent those types of situations from happening?
Well, not... In relation to not having the minister approve it. Remember that piece of legislation, matrimonial real property law, again, is a piece of federal legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And the scope, if you want, of what the community wanted was to hear everything, you know, for division of matrimonial assets, divorce, separation, child support, all those things. What was developed right now in Ganawagi for the matrimonial property law doesn't really go that far in its scope. It touches as far as what the court can provide, if you want, or what the restorative justice program can provide, is for two people, if they're willing to come to a mediated settlement, and that would be deposited in superior court, because divorce is federal. Okay? So we'd like to get them to that point where they'd recognize the mediation session that we had over here that was provided, the parties agree, come to get that homologated or recognized in a Ganawagi court, and then it's done. It sounds easy, but it's not, because the requirement to pass that matrimonial real property law is under a federal regulation. Again, I believe it's a double majority. 25% of your population need to vote on it. So the voting...
And then at least 50% of those voters need to be in favor of it.
That's right.
Right.
So, but we don't vote on that. We have instituted the community decision-making process, which is not... jive, if you would, with the regulations under that, or the requirements under the matrimonial real property law. So we're at a conflict now. We've passed something as an emergency law, if you would, approved by the community and put in place by a Mohawk Council resolution. But yet that piece of legislation needs to be approved by the minister. Minister says you didn't follow the regulations, so we're not going to approve it. So the political will, that's outside of an operational one. We can have all the processes in place. And even if we did hear a file such as that, what do we do with that judgment? The same thing is happening has happened in Akwesasne, where they have their Mohawk court. And some of their judgments, I mean, the judgments that are handed down from the bench, they can't enforce. So the judges are frustrated, the administration is frustrated, police are frustrated, community members are frustrated, saying you created something and you went on your own and you said you don't care what anyone says, but now what do we do with these judgments? So that next step needs to take place, meaning that political table discussion and the willingness to be able to move forward on this.
So in some ways... having some of the issues that might be covered by the Justice Act recognized will have to do with which political party takes power after every federal election.
Exactly. It's going to have to do with negotiating our way through that for the recognition that we need in order to empower.
Now, when we talk about negotiation, there's this idea of some give and take, right?
Yes.
It's not just all Ganawagi take, take, take. What is the federal government, so far saying
not sure
it
yet,
needs
because
to
we
look
haven't,
like?
We haven't opened the doors with them at this point.
Okay.
We're just speaking
but
with the
on
province.
On one issue, on reciprocity. Mm-hmm. Reciprocity involves two sides. I give you, you give me. Mm-hmm. So that there's that aspect. We don't want to entirely be always on the giving side, but we want to have our powers recognized. You can say, we can say we have power and we'll be blue in the face how much we want. This community has always wanted power.
Now, this idea of jurisdiction, we heard a lot about having Ganawagi's jurisdiction recognized leading up to the election. The Justice Act is a part of that? That's something that needs to be passed? Or... is it the Justice Act and then, negotiations every time there's a change of cabinet?
Well, I don't think it's in cabinet. I think it's just in relation to the Justice Act itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once that's, I think there's a real opportunity for Quebec to realize that we have the responsibility to do that. And they may have to change their own legislation to accommodate that. And I think we're going in that direction. There's that possibility. But when we're speaking about different pieces of legislation, and this is where it gets a little bit convoluted, when we think the Justice Act is going to be a catch-all for everything. There's federal legislation out there that is restrictive in relation to what Gunawagi we want to do as far as jurisdiction is concerned. So that legislation would need to be discussed, if you would. And I mean, just giving you the example of the criteria of the double majority aspect for the MRI law and even for the membership law. So that's outside the realm of a Justice Act. That's a political will or a political accord that would be required.
So the Justice Act it's passed or it's accepted by council. Was there ever any consideration of having, you know, a community vote or referendum on having it accepted or elements that it should cover?
It's been through the whole process under CDMP over a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it went through all of that. All the table could do at that point was to say that they accepted what the people placed before us in all of the hearings, and there was no other way. This is what the community wanted, and we then therefore signed off as chiefs. This was the will of the people. There was no one who held back on this.
Okay, we've got to take another quick break, but we'll be right back. Our guests right now in studio, Christine Dion-Zachary and Ron Sky, we're talking about the Justice Act. And we're back on the K103.7 FM Party Line Talk Show. Our guests in studio today, Christine Dion-Zachary and Ron Sky, we're talking about the Justice Act. We had a question come in off air. Somebody was wondering, should something of this importance be brought to a referendum? And, you know, we were talking about it a bit off air, how it went through the CDMP process.
Yes, community decision making.
Right.
For this Justice Act, it went through 7 years of intense community discussion. Just for the first hearing on justice, I think there were about 36 sessions where people came and spoke about the different clauses in there and what they wanted. I played a lot. I was involved quite a bit on that development, and a lot of very interesting people attended from the community.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just to get the first draft of that justice law. And then the second draft, similarly, many, many people and even visitors who attended were really impressed with the style of legislation development. So it was a tremendously well attended and much input from the community on this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've got to think the whole process itself, the community decision-making model, if you would, was kind of a little bit of an impetus from 2006, 2007, when the community said they wanted to have more involvement in decisions, how council made laws and so on. So there was a project that was developed with the OCC, Office of Council of Chiefs, the traditional working group, and some members of council to develop this model, and the model's been evolving since the beginning, you know, and it's taking the feedback from the community, saying it they wanted input, wanted to be involved, and then once now you have to participate. So some of the feedback we got is it's too long. You know, we we elected council members to make decisions. Let them make it now. So you're getting various comments or sentiments across the scale. And some people say, no, we love it. We love going there to be able to discuss and for you to hear what we need to say. So this was the first one that went through this community decision-making process. I think we were able to do outreach, if you want, or people that participated. It was over 800 people, you know, that the provided input that are attended at the sessions. And as we developed this, we have to remember, again, I said it was a grassroots development. We had three community members that were assigned to the technical working team, if you would, and we poured over volumes and volumes of information from the community. So it wasn't made by the Justice Commission, you know, said, this is what it is. No, we went through every session of consultation that we had, and before we moved forward, the community members that we had on there as kind of the oversight had to agree that yes, this is what was said, this is what was the sentiment behind it, let's move on to the next section. So it was very, very tedious, very, very time consuming, and you know, that was the product that we see now is the result of all that work.
Okay.
And that product eventually came the third reading. was of that, the third draft was read in, and then it came to council. And this was the certainty that we required, that following all of this intense involvement of the community, this is the people speaking. This is what they said they wanted. And so, therefore, we signed off on the will of the people. That is the style of this legislation and this legislative style that we've taken on.
Okay. We've spoken a bit about how the Justice Act in Ganawage still needs to be recognized by, you know, out the federal provincial judges. In order for that to happen, does it have to be consistent, or do we need to develop things that are consistent with, you know, something like the Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms, Canada's charters, in order to ensure that our laws are accepted? And how long does that take, or is it even necessary?
I think it's necessary. And as I was saying earlier, you hear that talk quite a bit now.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and I ask, how is it different from Mohawk Charter, Mohawk Rights and Freedoms? And you know, sometimes you get things and you put them side by side and they seem to resemble each other. So that's what's going to need further work. We need to develop what are our principles, what are our rights and freedoms. So that has to be developed, and they are there. And they are there in our traditions, just that people have never put it all together in one spot in a document. We haven't done that.
Is it possible that this Justice Act and its application could be steering the community away from traditional government, which the council was mandated to return to?
I think it's going the other way, really. Because the creation, if you want, and the implementation of this is going to be totally outside of Indian Act or any other piece of legislation. It's something that's homegrown. And as I said, somehow Canada and Quebec are going to have to adjust their policies, their legislation, in order to recognize the responsibility that we have in relation to providing justice for our community.
Now, when Ron was speaking about components of the justice system, and he talked about ADR, alternative
dispute resolution,
you know, that has its roots in traditional justice. That's where it evolved from. 30 years ago, ADR suddenly became a buzzword, and that came from Ungwehungwe style of settlement of grievances. So it has a major, amazing root base in our tradition. So when you ask the question of does this justice take away from, does it take away from traditional justice? No, it doesn't. And the people who worked on this were people who came from traditional background and then incorporated this into a structure, the ADR structure.
Okay. And, you know, we're saying that provincial and federal judges, or that they're going to have to make this shift into accepting Ganawage's jurisdiction. Now, we say they're going to have to, but that doesn't mean they will. What do we have to ensure that that shift is going to be made?
It's not the judges.
Okay.
Okay. It's
politicians.
It's their legislative framework. What they're responsible for, or if you want, their liabilities within the their constitution.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So they have to provide certain assurances, if you would, in relation to justice, the dispensing of justice, meaning the objectivity of the justice. How are they appointed? To ensure that there's no political influence. So all of those checks and balances, in a free and democratic society, you want to have that. You want to make sure that your judges aren't going to be influenced by, the flavor of the day, if you would, or from a political party. So they need to be assured, if you want, that those are incorporated in the Ganawage Justice Act. And as I said, we're on that track. They understand that.
And how do we ensure that this happens? Just, you know, because with the Indian Act in place, the Indian Act is set up so that we don't develop things like a Justice Act and have jurisdiction in some ways. And that's the way a lot of people feel.
Yeah,
so how do you get around that?
I don't see it that way at all, because the 107 court would not have developed. 107 came right out of the Indian Act. And in the 40s, it was just two men who were JPs in our town. And gradually, we got an actual physical building for justice. And then the laws that we were able to deal with, and the charges that we were able to deal with, that's what grew us. That's what made us develop. And now we've developed to another stage where we're moving towards recognition of our rights.
What kind of response, or has there been any sort of response from other First Nations when they hear about Ganawagay's Justice Act?
I know other First Nations communities want to know, how is it that we have a court? How is it that we have police officers? How is it that we're able to negotiate for our peacekeepers, you know, for the growth of our peacekeepers? And they don't realize how much work went into that and how many decades of work Ganawaga has put into these topics and how things have developed as a result of that work. So, I mean, the fact that we've got a peacekeeper law, the fact that we've got a Justice Act, those are where we base our growth.
Okay. So, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank both of you for coming in.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you, Ron.